Just how far do the freedom of speech, First Amendment rights of college students go on college campuses? They have come into question on numerous campuses, including at the University of Missouri in Columbia. Joining me in studio to discuss it is Ari Cohn, the Senior Program Officer for Legal and Public Advocacy for FIRE. That's the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. His organization works to promote and sustain individual rights of students on campus. Ari, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of threats does FIRE see on our campus vis-a-vis First Amendment?
Well, the threat to free speech on college campuses has been ongoing for, well, the entirety of FIRE's 16-year existence at this point. And the game changes ever so slightly every now and then. The threats come from different places. But these days what we're seeing, more so than the old school administrative desire for peace and quiet on campus, although we still do see that and the desire to not be criticized, we see students demanding to be free from offense, free from ideas that make them uncomfortable. For the first time really in the history of campus censorship, we're seeing a really large and very distressing trend of students clamoring to be censored themselves. Of course, well, to censor each other.
How do you explain that? I mean, these are college campuses, after all, where free thought is usually encouraged, always used to be.
Well, and it still should be. I mean, that is the hallmark of higher education. And actually, in an article for The Atlantic this past fall, FIRE President Greg Lukianoff and John Haidt wrote an article called The Coddling of the American Mind, where they go into a fair amount of explanation as to what possibly could be causing this. I think a lot of it comes down to we're teaching kids at a young age that the world is a big, scary place, and they're not prepared to deal with it. And frankly, when college administrators accede to these demands and say, okay, well, you're offended, I will shut up the person who offended you, we're teaching students that it is much easier to silence your opponent than actually refute them and debate them. And when faced with the difficult task of refuting and debating versus the easy task of complaining and having them shut up, it's pretty obvious which is the easier choice to take, and who can blame them, really? We're teaching them that it works.
We're seeing something else on a number of college campuses, and these are free zones, I guess they're called. What are they called?
Free speech zones.
Free speech zones where students can go and say pretty much whatever they want.
Well, the irony of free speech zones is that they are generally small and out of the way, and by virtue of their existence, designate the rest of campus as a not free speech zone, a place where you can't speak your mind. We've had cases involving free speech zones located in small gazebos, muddy patches, a basketball court, and to declare that the large majority, sometimes well over 99.5% of campus, is not a free speech zone, really, again, violates that fundamental value of free thought and inquiry that colleges and universities are supposed to stand for.
There's another side to this coin, too, and we've been reading in recent years about students complaining about things that the professors are saying and offering them texts, for instance, that may have subject matter that the students feel is not politically correct, perhaps, or discriminatory somehow.
Sure. And we're seeing a lot of pushes for trigger warnings from students that professors be required to give trigger warnings.
Exactly.
When any material might, cause students to feel uncomfortable or really harken back to an experience that student had in the past.
Or Mark Twain, because the N-word is used in his writing. Some students don't want to be subjected to that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. Ovid's Metamorphoses were also targeted. And the fact of the matter is that trigger warnings, when used properly, they don't come from a bad place. They come from a place where they're used to help prevent people from who have PTSD, who have severe actual, issues from – having flashbacks triggered or negative reactions or attacks. But when it comes down to it, the trigger warnings we're seeing demanded nowadays are so broad that they're basically being used as a way to avoid ideas. And that's where it gets dangerous, because in reality, the college classroom is the single safest place to explore uncomfortable and even dangerous ideas.
Well, how does your organization, how does FIRE enter the picture? And when it sees something that is contrary to your beliefs, how do you act and what tools do you have?
Well, we have several tools. Through the 16 years we've existed, we've grown rapidly recently especially. But one of our primary things is we educate. We educate students. We educate faculty. We educate administrators on what the rights of the campus community are and how they can be best upheld. We work collaboratively, and we love to work collaboratively with colleges and universities to reform their policies, to make them ideal. We love to hand out green light ratings, which is our best free speech rating, saying that this school's policies adequately uphold free speech, and this is a place where you can go and express yourself and learn from each other. We also advocate on behalf of students who have had their rights violated and faculty. And where necessary, we help take schools to court in order to force them to reform their unconstitutional policies, at least when it comes to public institutions. And we do all of these things. We have student outreach. We collaborate with anyone who's willing to collaborate with us, and we never charge for our services.
Where do you get your money?
We get our money primarily from small private individual donors, so we receive grants from all over the place.
What kind of success have you had in altering attitudes and views over your 16 years?
Well, we've won over 240 public cases affecting more than 2 million students throughout our various programs. We've reformed countless policies, and the ripple effect that has is really – it's hard to describe, because when a student sees another student being punished and they say, now I don't feel comfortable expressing myself – if we can undo that damage by publicly revising these policies and therefore making every single student on that campus feel much more secure in their expressive rights, it's hard to beat that. That's what we're in this for.
Right. And you're often, as I understand it, taking the side of those who are accused in sexual abuse cases. Is that a typical event for you?
Well, our concern in those cases is less about the eventual outcome. It's the process that is used to make these determinations. And we think that any student accused of any misconduct on campus deserves a fair shake, deserves procedures that protect their rights so that we can be confident that when one of these decisions is handed down and a student is found responsible for what sometimes amounts to a serious felony, that they've been part of a reliable process that's there to find the truth instead of a process that is unfortunately all too often broken and not aligned with the right incentives and doesn't give accused students the procedural protections that we'd expect people accused of such serious things to get.
I guess the Duke lacrosse case might be a case in point for something like that.
Sure would.
Yeah, sure would. What about the Melissa Click situation at the University of Missouri? It's gotten a lot of attention here, obviously. Have you guys at FIRE been involved in that whole process at all?
Well, we haven't been involved in that particular instance. And look, the video speaks for itself. But Melissa Click, like any other professor at the University of Missouri, also deserves those procedural protections that are set out in the faculty handbook and the principles of shared governance. And the American Association of University Professors has expressed concerns that perhaps her rights were violated. And if that's the case, if those procedural protections were violated, then we have concerns about that as well. But I will also say that the push by the legislature is concerning to us. We're wary and skeptical about legislative interference with academic decisions that properly belong in the university and its established processes and procedures. State universities should properly be independent and have the ability to make those academic decisions for themselves, being those academic experts who are best suited to make those decisions.
You mentioned that the video speaks for itself. Just elaborate on that. Does that mean it's kind of hands-off because the freedom of the press issue of the First Amendment, for instance, which she was trying to compromise?
Well, the actions that she took, some say they were justified. Some say they were not. That's something that is a matter for the prosecutor to determine whether or not she broke any laws, and frankly, whether for the academic community to determine whether that's something that they want to be a part of their university, to be representative of it. And whether that they consider that misconduct, you know, that's something that I leave to the judgment of the impacted communities, really.
Well, the university has made it clear at this point that that she is dismissed and she's going to stay dismissed. But the organization you mentioned, the American Association of University Professors, are handling an appeal that that she has forwarded to that organization. Does that group have any clout?
The AAUP certainly does have clout. They have been instrumental recently in the reforming or the work towards reforming academic freedom issues at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign with regards to the unhiring of Stephen Salida. And they investigate and censure universities across the country that have found to been found to violate faculty rights and academic freedom and due process issues. And we've worked with them before and we'll continue to work with them.
We have a tweet here I'd like to get you to respond to. It's because it's a tweet. It's not very detailed, but here is what Bob writes. This debate is off due to improper framing. The guest lectures us on what oppressed people should tolerate as free speech. How do you interpret that? I'm not sure.
Can
that
you repeat that?
The debate is off to improper framing. The guest lectures us on what oppressed people should tolerate as free speech.
Well, free speech is a difficult topic. It has implications, and free speech can hurt, and there's no sense in denying that. It does no damage to the principles of free speech to acknowledge it. And at the end of the day, the system of free speech that we have is the best one that we can really hope to live in. It's not just oppressed people that have to live with difficult speech. A lot of people have to live with difficult speech, and it's not easy. It is difficult. But that's the system of liberal science that we live in, the public debate, the checking of ideas through public discourse. And I think really what it comes down to is, when is the last time that anyone has seen an oppressed minority implementing a law restricting speech? Mm. Never. It's always a powerful majority, which is usually the tyrannical force causing the minority to be oppressed. And that's not a power I particularly like handing them.
Mm-hmm. Right. What are you working on now with FIRE? Is there something that is regional or local that you're involved with?
Well, nothing too local right now. We work on stuff across the country. So sure. The particular work we're doing at any time could be anywhere. We've recently covered issues like the California State University Los Angeles issue with the Ben Shapiro speech, where he was basically protesters prevented people from getting in and listening to his speech. There was at Williams College, a student, as part of an uncomfortable learning series, invited a fellow by the name of John Derbyshire, who many consider to be racist based on his writings. And the university president or the college president disinvited him, saying that, you know, I don't think that he should be able to speak on this on this college campus. Never mind the fact that the person who invited him, the student who invited him, was a black student who wanted to invite him for the purpose of hearing him out and then knocking down his arguments publicly. And the level of paternalism that came down in the explanation that you are not prepared to handle this kind of speech, this speech doesn't belong here, is really just very emblematic of the entire problem that we're facing here on campuses. And we don't really need that lesson to be taught to the students any more than it already has.
We went through that at Washington University, where students were opposed to Phyllis Schlafly, for instance, speaking.
I remember that.
Right. Were you involved in that, by any chance?
I'm not sure if we were actually involved in that. That was before my time at FIRE, although I do remember the incident. But we've definitely noticed it. We have something called the disinvitation database on our website, where people can look up the incidents where students, faculty, or community members have asked that schools disinvite controversial speakers. It's something we've been interested in tracking for a while, so we like to keep tabs on all of these events. And Phyllis is definitely on our list.
Time is limited here, but we have a tweet from Amy, I guess it is, who writes, "The big outcome of college experience is building self-awareness, which often requires a thick skin. Welcome to the world." That's pretty much in line with what you folks are thinking, right?
Sure, but I might mitigate it a little bit and say that self-awareness doesn't necessarily come from thick skin, but you can't really be self-aware unless you've battled the opposite ideas. You can't reach the right conclusions without discarding the wrong ones. You have to go through that process to really become self-aware and understand why you feel the way you do.
This conversation can be continued tonight at the Anheuser-Busch Leadership Room at Spelman Center on the St. Charles campus of Lindenwood University. There's an event titled Free Speech and Inclusion, Friend or Foe. And your organization, FIRE, is a part of that, right?
Yes.
Anybody invited?
Everyone is invited.
All righty. That's from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Lindenwood University. Ari Cohen, thanks so much for being with us and telling us about your organization and what your principles are and what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Don.
Great meeting you. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.